The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Here's a sample of a free podcast from the Post Wrestling Cafe. $6 gets you through the door at postwrestlingcafe.com.
Hey everyone, it's John Pollock. It is Friday, May the 3rd, and we have a free audio news update posted for everybody today. Coming up a little later on, Jack Wannon is going to be with me as we chat about UFC 301 that is going down on Saturday night. But let us go to the latest on the Janelle Grant lawsuit, because there was a big statement issued on behalf of John Laurinaitis through his lawyer, Edward Brennan, on Thursday. The statement reads, quote, John Laurinaitis has filed a motion today, fully joining in and adopting Vince McMahon's motion to compel arbitration. Mr. Laurinaitis corroborates Mr. McMahon in publicly declaring that Ms. Grant's allegations of sexual abuse and coercion in her complaint are completely unfounded. My client will fight these false allegations together with Mr. McMahon in the proper forum, arbitration, end quote. This statement is in stark contrast to the previous statement that Brennan had issued to Post Wrestling and WrestleNomics back in April, where he said, quote, Judge Callahan was a learned judge and a skilled litigator. I anticipate she will ultimately see that Mr. Laurinaitis is, like her client, a victim in this case, and Judge Callahan will do the right thing and dismiss my client from the lawsuit. In the event she does not, my client will clear his name and reputation in court, not in the media. In response to Thursday's filing, there was a statement issued to Post Wrestling, among other media outlets, from Jessica Rosenberg, who's the lawyer for Vince McMahon. She stated, quote, in January 2024, Ms. Grant, a 43-year-old with a law degree who was in love with Mr. McMahon and devastated by their breakup, filed an outrageous and false lawsuit to ruin Mr. McMahon's career and reputation. Now, her false allegations are slowly unraveling. Today, Mr. Laurinaitis' attorney confirmed his client will corroborate Mr. McMahon's account and expose the lies within the complaint. Despite their intense efforts, Ms. Grant's attorneys won't be able to suppress the truth from coming out. End quote. This leaves the WWE as the lone defendant that needs to respond to the case and has until June the 1st. Laurinaitis is a key figure, and his response was important because he would have been able to corroborate Grant's allegations and indicated that that was what was going to be happening. However, Laurinaitis is now backing McMahon's assertion that the allegations are false and seeking arbitration as the venue for this case to be heard in. It's worth noting that Laurinaitis was not attached to the non-disclosure agreement between McMahon and Grant, which was signed in January of 2022. After a brief role within the XFL, Grant was transferred to the talent relations department, reporting to Laurinaitis with the assurance that she would be promoted to a VP role within a year of the transfer. In the suit, Grant stated that she was directed to visit Laurinaitis at the start of the workday for sexual encounters, along with engaging in sexual activity at WWE headquarters. Grant also alleges she was sexually assaulted by McMahon and Laurinaitis at the WWE's headquarters in June of 2021. After the initial reporting by the Wall Street Journal, Laurinaitis was dismissed by WWE in August of 2022, which was 2 weeks after McMahon's first resignation from the company. The response from WWE is going to be interesting, given that they would wish to see this case disappear and distance itself from the parties. It makes it difficult for WWE to align with McMahon and Laurinaitis, even if all three have a vested interest in exonerating themselves. WWE would have to justify the dismissals of Laurinaitis and this past January's resignation by McMahon while they're embarking on this campaign of its new era, which every observer sees as code for Vince McMahon is gone. McMahon and Laurinaitis want this to be settled privately in arbitration, with the notion that the language of the NDA dictates that option, while Grant's side is arguing the NDA was nullified on multiple grounds, including halted payments and language in the Speak Out Act. For McMahon, you can argue that the private nature of arbitration is not the best venue to remedy his reputation, which has been impacted publicly, but he is looking to rehabilitate privately. Only McMahon can answer what his ultimate play is. Is he only out for reputational rehabilitation? Or does he have a grand plan that by clearing his name, he has a pathway back into the business world? Does that go so far as to believe that McMahon feels he could get back to WWE? The latter seems completely completely out of reach, and given the structure of his TKO stock, this is not the same circumstance as before, where McMahon had the power to force himself back into that position with the company. On the Grant side, it has been steadfast regarding their decision to move forward with the case, and while a settlement is always a possible outcome, they have been adamant that no talks have taken place in that direction. For the foreseeable future, this is likely to play out publicly and get uglier, with both sides attacking the other. We know that McMahon has enlisted the services of Citric & Company, which is a high-powered PR firm designed for crisis management. Brandon Thurston and I have reached out to multiple parties involved, and we will continue to cover this story aggressively. Multiple reports have come out, first from the Wrestling Observer newsletter, that WWE's chief operating officer Brad Blum has reportedly resigned from his position at the company. Dave Meltzer is reporting that Blum tendered his resignation on May the 1st, with Mike Johnson corroborating that reporting. According to Meltzer's reporting, Blum made the decision to resign, and no one forced him out of the company. As we had reported through Front Office Sports earlier this year, Blum was corporate officer number 2 in Janelle Grant's lawsuit against WWE, Vince McMahon, and John Laurinaitis. The lawsuit alleges that Blum was a key lieutenant of McMahon and was instrumental in the hiring of Janelle Grant in 2019, when Blum was serving as executive vice president in charge of operations. We have reached out to the WWE and Brad Blum directly for confirmation on his resignation and if it went into effect immediately or if there is an end date coming up for Blum and his position in WWE. He was first hired by the company in 2006. Ethan Page is no longer under contract with WWE or Ring of Honor. Earlier this week, it was noted that his profile was removed from the AEW website, with Fightful Select confirming that he is no longer under contract to the entity. The 34-year-old left Impact Wrestling at the end of 2020 to join AEW, making his debut at the Revolution pay-per-view in March of 2021. Throughout his tenure, he teamed with Scorpio Sky as the Men of the Year with manager Dan Lambert, and then was briefly part of The Firm alongside The Guns, Big Bill, Lee Moriarty, and Stokely Hathaway. Last summer, he challenged MJF for the AEW title in Page's hometown of Hamilton, Ontario, and his last match for AEW proper occurred in Montreal last December against Kenny Omega. Since then, he has had 6 matches for Ring of Honor, Last Wrestling in February, and has worked several independent dates since then. Fightful Select is reporting that Seth Rollins has signed a new multi-year deal with WWE that is said to be worth, quote, big money. His deal was set to expire in June, and the performer is currently on the sidelines after undergoing knee surgery earlier this month following WrestleMania 40. New Japan Pro Wrestling was in Fukuoka earlier today in front of 2,440 fans at the International Center for their first of 2 Wrestling Dontaku cards. In the main event, Nick Nemeth retained the IWGP Global Heavyweight title, defeating Hiroshi Tanahashi. David Finlay defeated Yota Tsuji. And we have a new television champion as Jeff Cobb unseated Zack Sabre Jr. in 13 minutes, 28 seconds after the tour of the islands and ends Zack Sabre Jr.'s second reign with the championship, which was very short-lived after Zack Sabre Jr. had just beaten Matt Riddle for the title. And in a 6-man tag, Evil, Ren Narita, and Yoshinobu Kanemaru defeated IWGP champion John Moxley, Shota Umino, and El Desperado. The second Dontaku event goes down late tonight, 2 a.m. Eastern Time, early Saturday morning, with Moxley defending the IWGP world title against Ren Narita. Also in action, NEVER openweight champion Shingo Takagi defends against Gabe Kidd. The IWGP tag titles will be at stake, with Hirooki Goto and Yoshihashi defending against Chase Owens and Kenta. And in an 8-man tag, LIJ's Tetsuya Naito, Yota Tsuji, Hiromu Takahashi, and Bushi take on the War Dogs of David Finlay, Clark Connors, Drilla Maloney, and Ghetto, while Hiroshi Tanahashi and Nick Nemeth, opponents on Night 1, are teammates on Night 2 against Taichi and Takemichi Noku in the top matches. We will have coverage of both nights of Wrestling Dontaku coming your way Saturday at postwrestlingcafe.com with Bruce Lord and Karen Peterson. And before we get to Jack Wanon, story from Neil Flanagan up on the site, Ricochet has defeated Johnny Gargano to become the first WWE Speed Champion. Gargano was defeated with the recoil, followed by a lethal injection from Ricochet. Ricochet made his way to today's final after defeating Dragon Lee and JD McDonagh, while Gargano had defeated Bronson Reed and Angel to advance. No sooner had Ricochet held up the title than it was announced that a number one contenders tournament begins May the 8th. Apollo Crews will face Ivar, and Tyler Bate will go against Berto. The winners of those matches face each other, with the winner getting the shot at Ricochet. Now we're going to go on over and welcome in Jack Wanon as we look ahead to UFC 301, as well as Jack's Wednesday night outing in Winnipeg, Manitoba. Continuing on today's audio news update, we are joined by Jack Wanon from the site, who is on location in Winnipeg, Manitoba, as we speak. And Jack, before we get into any MMA discussion, you are coming off the Manitoba Massacre on Wednesday night at the Canada Life Center, and you got to take this whole thing in. What was your experience like at AEW on Wednesday?
Yeah, the Manitoba Massacre, as you called it, was that the official term for it? I never heard that in the venue, but I thought that was really catchy.
It is what they called the main event, yes, with Willow Nightingale and Sky Blue.
Yeah, I mean, that was a really stellar main event. I thought they stole the show with that one. For all the people who were talking about the crowd being dead, listen, this is a city in mourning. We were less than 24 hours removed from the Jets being eliminated from the playoffs, so I feel like, listen, you guys need to cut them some slack. Under many other contexts, that would have been a very justifiable time. 11 minutes into the show, we were reminded about the Jets being eliminated. It was a very hard night.
It was. They certainly felt like they were in mourning for certain over most of the period. But how did you feel just about the 3-hour format as well? Like, you know, taking into account the big angle that they did, it seemed like Kenny Omega was kind of the big star of the show, and yet this heavy angle and then an hour of wrestling to follow, which, I mean, from the broadcast, it did seem like Willow and Sky Blue did bring the crowd into things for their main event. I thought they did very well in that position.
Well, I think it's interesting to sort of still test the idea of 10 p.m. being your sort of culmination and then having a sort of come down, because realistically, maybe you aren't going to have a crowd that wants to keep watching through to the 11 p.m. time, or maybe just a crowd that doesn't want to watch 3 hours of wrestling on a Wednesday. Like, I feel like there is something to testing out the idea of if you keep Rampage as this brand and sort of have it as this like after dark show, which I feel like they really do, even on Wednesdays before, they didn't have that block before it, because you have the show starting at 10 p.m. on a Friday, you know it's the sort of low-key thing. All of the presentation of it feels very after dark and low key. If they kept it like that after Dynamite, I wouldn't hate that. How much that would actually work, I'm not too sure. I feel like you can't really take any of the ratings right now as gospel, because so much of it is just NBA, NHL affected, and you can't really isolate those certain weeks as examples of how certain things in the show aren't working, in my opinion.
Are you expecting in this next round of negotiations that, you know, we have seen now weeks of the 3-hour block, it's going to continue next Saturday and the following week after that? Are you looking at, like, this is, especially if they stay with Warner Brothers Discovery, that a 3-hour block is probably inevitable? Or could you see them, like, realizing that it's a big ask of your audience, even though for the network it might be a more viable option to put Rampage following pro wrestling programming rather than on its own?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's totally possible. I like you said before, it seems intentional. They're clearly doing this over and over by putting these 3-hour blocks together. And I don't know. Something about it seems like a possibility they're open to. Though it's hard to tell with these weeks where they're really just like the schedule is just clearly trying to survive as much as it can. Like, we're not even having collision these weeks. It's just very odd for the schedule.
Well, they didn't want to go head to head with UFC 301. I mean, this card is just,
this is a ratings killer card right here. Are you kidding me?
So as two Canadians here, Let us state what is up for grabs on Saturday night. From the combat sports world, this pales in comparison to the interest that the Canelo-Alvarez fight is going to have, which is going to be broadcast at the same time as the pay-per-view main card. Plus, you happen to have, again, specific to Canada, Game 7 between the Toronto Maple Leafs and Boston Bruins. This UFC 301 card is just, to me, one of the smallest profile pay-per-views I can recall from the UFC. I think it's a very unattractive card on paper. And I more so have like a strong resistance to it because it comes with such a high price tag. Like, this is really testing your pay-per-view buying audience.
Yeah, and I think that something that hurts this card definitely is coming after 300, which is the card of all cards. Even if this card was better, it is still going to be judged on that comparison to one of the best lineups start to finish we've ever seen. I don't think this is a horrible lineup. I think this is certainly a weak one. You know, we have one title fight and it's not the strongest title fight. And below that, really not too much else on the card. I still think there's some quality matchups on here and stuff.
There's quality fights. I think, yeah, where I like, more so just from a marquee standpoint. That yes, I think if you're selling a pay-per-view, like this is a, like Steve Ersig headlining a pay-per-view is about as low profile as you can get.
Where you're going to struggle here is finding that audience that maybe just tunes in for those big pay-per-view shows and just tunes in for those big fights. Think of that friend, that those friends in your orbit that know you as the MMA person and ask you when the MMA card is happening. Those people are going to be hard to sell on a lineup like this.
Well, it is headlined by Alexandra Pantoja and the 10th ranked Steve Ersig for the flyweight championship. Ersig began fighting in 2016 and joined the UFC only last year, but he is 3-0. He is coming off a knockout of Matt Schnell to get this championship fight. I think for Pantoja, this guy's a fantastic fighter. I think fighting in Brazil, he's going to feel like a big star on this card, probably second only to Jose Aldo. I think that you can look at Steve Ursa, like this is without question the biggest fight of his life and one that you can't completely dismiss him as a challenger, even if you're just transfixed by where this guy is in the flyweight rankings and such. But it's just a fight that is definitely going to be flying under the radar, to say the least.
Yeah, and I think this is a really interesting fight because Ersig has his rise up to the UFC has been so quick. I mean, not even a year ago, he was still fighting on the regionals in Australia. Mm-hmm. I think he is just such an interesting character in how really low key his rise to the top has been. I remember when I first sort of found out about him fighting in the UFC, I searched up his gym because I was like, where is he fighting out of? And I realized this gym he's fighting out of is a place where he is working as a children's instructor. So it was just such a cool sort of mom and pop shop place that he was coming out of. But he has some really legit wins. He came onto the scene with a upset victory over David Dvorak. He has beat Alessandro Costa, and he's coming off a real strong walk-off finish win against Matt Schnell. Those are three really respectable names. Even though he's ranked 10th in the division, you know, he has some really strong victories under his belt, and he's definitely an underdog heading into this weekend, but not one I would want to count out.
No, when you look at like the odds, like this is not like Pantoja is this overwhelming favorite. DraftKings lists him at a -185. So I certainly feel this is one of those like sometimes observers can kind of get trapped in the like who is this guy kind of mentality and divorce like the marketing aspect versus the quality in terms of a fighter. Yes. That, you know, Ersig is like it's certainly not this this crazy mismatch at all, especially at flyweight, where I think they're just hungry for some challengers that are not named Brandon Moreno.
Well, Ersig is kind of an unknown to a lot of people, and it's not to his fault at all. I mean, you have three UFC fights. Two of them were on prelim pay-per-views, and the third was on a Apex fight night. It's going to be very easy for you to go unnoticed by a lot of people who maybe only watch some of the bigger fights. So he's really going into this with a lot to prove to a lot of people. And I think he is seen as a bigger underdog in the eyes of some fans than he realistically is, I think.
Probably, well, not probably, the biggest star on this card is Jose Aldo, coming out of, I would say, the loosely defined retirement since he walked away way back in August of 2022. Since that time, participating in several boxing fights, and he's back here. And it's an interesting fight here with Jonathan Martinez, who is unbeaten he's 10-3 in the UFC since 2018, but he's won his last six fights. So this does feel as though this is a fight for raising the profile of Jonathan Martinez, but I think that would be very dangerous to look at Jose Aldo as some guy that is completely divorced from his prime. There's a very realistic path to victory here for Jose Aldo, which makes it very interesting of what Aldo's path is if he were to get a victory here.
You cannot count out Jose Aldo. I mean, you look at his record and you have to realize he retired after a loss to Mirab Dvalishvili. Mirab is next in line for a title fight. And before then, Aldo had three wins in a row. This is a guy who claimed retirement while he was still in a really solid spot in the division. This is another tough challenge for Jonathan Martinez, one he's certainly ready for. And I think this is actually pretty great matchmaking. The only thing that might throw people off is the idea that you're putting someone who's coming out of retirement into a big time fight. But this is not a guy, I mean, with all due respect to Jose Aldo, he was not retired. He boxed three times in his first year of retirement, and now he's back to MMA. I mean, listen, I'm not buying it. This is it's going to be interesting to see how he does. I mean, I think that even though his retirement wasn't a retirement at all, there's something to be said about, you know, okay, well, this guy, he has lots of fights under his belt. He is, I think, 38 years old now.
37. You
know, 37. How is he going to look? I mean, 37 isn't old, but for someone who has fought as in the UFC as many times as he has, I think there is something to be said about, you know, how, every time he goes out there, how will he just look mileage-wise?
Yeah, I mean, one of the major observations has been Jose Aldo just like a reticence to engage in the leg kicks that were so well associated with him throughout his featherweight run. Even like a less than optimal Jose Aldo, I think this is going to be a very big challenge for Jonathan Martinez. And I guess the question is, like, win or lose, are you expecting Jose Aldo, like, that this represents more than just a one-off for him coming back to the UFC? Because I think a win, it becomes very interesting. Like, does this guy have aspirations of competing at bantamweight, or is this just simply, this was a great offer that he got to help a struggling pay-per-view, and he's not looking at this as some full-time return to MMA?
Well, it's interesting. I think this fight was, so he was still under contract when he did the boxing, and he was just granted permission from UFC to go do those fights. And this, he still had this contract active during that time with this fight. But I don't know what his situation is after this fight, whether this is the last on his contract or if he would have to renegotiate. And I think that is certainly an important part of the whole process. I really don't know. I mean, when you look at someone who, you know, quote unquote retired and then fought three times on small boxing shows in that time, does this seem like someone who wants to chase titles, or does it seem like someone who is happy to fight simply because that's something they love doing? I do think that, you know, unless he has some disastrous performance this weekend, I could totally see him sticking around beyond this fight, win or loss.
The main card, I mean, there is a bit of a theme to this, and Anthony Smith is going to be taking on Vitor Petrino in light heavyweight. Vitor Petrino is unbeaten, and with Anthony Smith, it seems like a lot of the discussion this week is about how much longer this guy wants to go when he has just an incredible resume of just quantity of fights that he has had. I don't think too many people see this guy of being championship caliber. He's lost three of his last four. This does feel designed for Vitor Petrino here, but are people overlooking Anthony Smith?
I mean, he's a tough challenge, and you know, as much as he really has been put into a gatekeeper position, he has shown that he is a good gatekeeper for the division. I do think that Petrino is going to win this, but this is one of those fights where, you know, Smith can, you know, get out a victory. And that's something he's done many times before when people were having the same conversation and saying, you know, hey, I don't like his odds here. So, I mean, this is kind of like the quintessential Anthony Smith fight, if you ask me.
Yeah, he is, Vitor Petrino among the biggest favorites on this card. He is listed here at a cool minus 575. So not a lot of optimism from odds makers regarding Anthony Smith. We also have Michel Pereira taking on Ihor Potieria and Paul Craig against Kyle Bahalio, rounding out the main card. What is intriguing in these two fights to you, Jack?
Well, I guess I'm interested to see the Brazilian talents on this main card. The matchups really do not interest me at all. This Pereira fight was booked on short notice after his previous opponent fell through. And this is, unfortunately for him, another fight where on paper he seems to be massively outskilled compared to, or massively way better than his opponent. I mean, his previous fight, I think it was at UFC 299, he just ran through his opponent. And then afterward, you looked at their records and you're like, why did this fight get made? I worry that we might be running into one of those situations again. Potieria is 2-3 in the UFC. Pereira is on like a 7-fight winning streak. So there you go. This other fight, Bahalio, I mean, I think he's a really great contender, and I'm really interested to see how he does in that matchup. So that's another one I'm really looking out for.
Yeah. And the undercard, I mean, there's a very good fight between Jack Shore and Joe Anderson Brito. That might be of interest. Karolina Kovalkiewicz, who once upon a time did challenge for the strawweight championship. She has now lost five consecutive fights and then turned things around. And all of a sudden she has won four straight and is taking on Yasmin Lucindo. So Karolina Kovalkiewicz, I mean, they gave her exceptional latitude in terms of a five-fight losing streak that you don't often see with someone staying in the UFC, but she has semi-turned things around, even she is at the latter stages of her career. And the rest of this card, Jack, we will see what it provides, but it's I don't know if this is going to be I am curious, and as someone that is very deep into the MMA media space, Jack, are you expecting a lot of MMA sites to dedicate more coverage to the Canelo Alvarez fight over UFC 301? What do you expect to see in terms of headline coverage at some of the leading MMA sites?
Oh yeah, those big boxing matches are a huge deal to cover. So I think, especially if it's Canelo, it's going to be he's probably going to get like a 70-30 share of the pie, but I mean, we'll see. I think that we have to remember Jose Aldo is a massive star, and you know, having him on this card is a pretty big deal. I think, you know, I think that he is one of those guys who can sort of get that nostalgia group interested. He has, you know, respect with the sort of newer fan base that has come in the recent years. So he does have some clout, and I think having him on this card really does help this lineup like immensely. Like, imagine how we'd be talking about this card if there was no Jose Aldo main event fight. We would be way more critical of it. It adds so much. If I can just talk about a couple prelim fights here.
Yes.
I'm really interested in this lightweight matchup between Elvis Brenner and Mick Tibek Orobai. They're just two really interesting prospects, and you know, in a division which is so deep like lightweight, you can have these guys with really stellar records that just go unnoticed. I mean, Orobai is 12-1-1. Brenner is 16-3 with three UFC wins. That's a really solid matchup. I think that a lot of these matchups where it's Brazil versus the world, it is kind of skewed for the Brazil guy to come out on top, but this is one where I'm really interested in either guy. Lower on the card, we also have Vince Paichel returning.
From hell, Pichel, yes.
Every time I see him on a card, I am so amazed by how does he have so few fights on his record, but has seemingly been in the UFC for like 20 years. So he is back for the first time since 2020.
And you know, just had to have, you know, a 4-year, you know, break, and now he's back.
I mean, yeah, he's a... I never really know what the situation is, but yeah, first time since 2022. It's almost like he's on like a contract where he's being iced out or something, except that's not the situation.
Well, he's got a very tough opponent in Ismael Bonfim. Yeah, I think this is one of those cards. Like, this has all the makings of one of those cards that Dana White comes out afterwards and say, everyone hated on this card. I have no doubt that, number one, I think the atmosphere will be pretty great for the show, especially for the Brazilian fighters that are on the card. The atmosphere should be great, and there's always the potential that we're going to have some great fights, but I think you do have to kind of separate when this is a pay-per-view. You're not selling a pay-per-view based on results. You're basing it off of marketing and interest in the lead-up to it, and I would argue this is one of the lower-end UFC pay-per-views that that they have put together. Like, in another era, Jack, like, you take out a Jose Aldo, even with a Jose Aldo, like, this is an ESPN card, and I just don't think that it does tell you kind of in this era where they have these guaranteed rights from ESPN. Yeah, you'll have the big cards, but then occasionally you will get a pay-per-view card like this, and they're not as reliant on putting together the card that's going to necessarily draw the biggest business.
Well, not to go to bat for UFC here, but I feel like, circumstantially, they really were in a tough position because they have, I think, two Brazilian champions on their roster, and one fought 3 weeks ago, and this is the only one that they could really book for this show, even though Alex Pereira was offering himself up, but he had like a broken finger or something, so it's like, no, you're not going to fight on this card. And I mean, it's a tough situation just because they needed to have Pereira on that 300 card because he was one of those guys where, you know, if you don't have that second title fight, people are going to be saying, why is this card so weak on the top part? And
all I want to know is Dana White going to have a highlight video for all the MMA media after this card? And
well,
and
all I'm, the business- I'm gonna, I'm going to send him a link to this podcast and say, listen carefully to what John's saying. You might need to put some crosshairs on him in your next video package.
Yeah, they'll definitely be isolating me and not you. So anyway.
I mean, my thing is that I hate the whole, this card ended up being good, because realistically, that really tends to have nothing to do with star power or talent. Like, you can have these regional cards where guys are getting killed with overhand rights and stuff, but it's usually because either the matchups are a little skewed, so one guy's beating on the other guy, or it's just a luck thing. I mean, I don't think that when UFC has these low power cards that end up being great, that's necessarily some testament to anything, because that really happens anywhere in the MMA world.
Well, here's the conclusion. Regardless of what you think about this card, I think UFC, they're going to be doing okay this year. They're going to be just fine. And
this is not a sink or swim moment for them.
No, I really don't feel this is a crossroads for the UFC. as we just saw, like the Polestar data for the gate figure that they drew for UFC 300 is just enormous. But there you go. It's UFC 301 coming up on Saturday night. Eric Marcotte and I will have a review Sunday, 11 a.m. Eastern on the Post YouTube channel. Jack, it's always great to catch up with you. Anything you want to throw out and plug?
No, not at all.
Your love of Winnipeg. Who's winning this game on Saturday night? Are the Leafs going to lose once again in a Game 7 situation to Boston?
Well, I think I'm going to have to side with my boss and say that the Leafs are going to lose. But no, just kidding. I don't know. I'm gonna be watching probably, but I'm one of those people who I'm not a huge, like I follow the Leafs, but like I don't follow every game, and I'm trying not to be the bandwagon person. So I'm gonna watch it just to stay within the conversation of the city.
How many screens are you gonna have going on Saturday night? What all are you gonna be taking in?
Oh, you should see it. Some days I have, I'll take a screenshot and put it on Twitter where I'll have like four screens going at once. I'll be watching like regional stuff. Like I'll have like an LFA card and a one championship card and like, you know, a KSW or whatever. It can get crazy sometimes.
Well, enjoy all the happenings, this coming weekend and Monday. It'll be a wonderful day in Toronto, as everybody is, they're on a high right now, Jack. Just wait till Monday, man. Are there going to be some upset people?
Well, that's when you win the first round of the Stanley Cup playoffs in Toronto, that's basically like winning the Stanley Cup. So,
it'll be a holiday for everybody.
I would shelter in place. Do not leave your house after Saturday night.
No, just stay home and watch the UFC 301 review with myself and Eric. Thanks to Jack for joining us. Again, we will have the UFC 301 post show Sunday, 11 a.m. Eastern at youtube.com/postwrestling. Before we get there, tonight we are live with Rewind to SmackDown. Tune in 10:05 Eastern here on The Cafe as we go through the SmackDown edition from France going into Backlash. We are not going to be doing calls tonight. Instead, we're going to hold off on calls until Saturday's show following Backlash. So we have lots of great content coming your way. We have the latest post pro res with WH Park and Karen Peterson, and then the Backlash show on Saturday. Sunday, we're live with the UFC 301 post show, and then we start it all over again on Monday with Rewind to Raw. That's it for your audio news update. If you've enjoyed this sample, considering jumping up to the double-double or espresso levels at postwrestlingcafe.com, as I put these out multiple times per week for our subscribers on those two tiers. Thanks, everybody, and we'll speak with you after SmackDown.